Welcome to the May podcast from the Learning and Development Professionals of Greater Philadelphia. My name is John Laskowski, co-founder and co-president of L&D Philly. In our podcast studio this month, we have Cynthia Clay, all the way live from Seattle, Washington. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi, John.
Cynthia and I will be talking about virtual training this month with questions submitted from attendees who were at our live events last week, our Philly Tech Week, as well as our Professional Development Series event. Quick word about L&D Philadelphia. The Learning and Development Professionals of Greater Philadelphia offers professional development opportunities for participants to sharpen their skills and learn how to use new technologies in a collaborative environment with best practices. We focus on instructional design, facilitation, and learning technology topics and trends. Our sessions are designed to be hands-on learning experiences where participants can apply what they learn in the moment, receive feedback, and gain insights on how to make improvements to their work from both colleagues as well as industry-leading professionals. Some of our upcoming events through the next 2 months. On May 18th, we'll be having an online webinar with Jonathan Peters about using gamification to improve talent development programs. In June, our monthly workshop will focus on the topic of cafeteria-style learning for adults. Jillian Douglas, author and expert, who's got a great new book out through ATD, will be joining us live over the internet at Drexel University on Saturday, June 17th. And then in July, we've got Rich McLaughlin and Ken Blackwell, two local experts on experiential learning, who'll be leading us in a workshop at the Best Western in King of Prussia on how to use experiential learning in your training and other leadership development programs. Our professional development series has two great workshops scheduled for 2017 as well. Next month in June, Jonathan Peters' boss, Monica Cornetti, the number one rated gamification expert in the world, will be leading us in a level one workshop on how to start using gamification in your training programs. And please note, it is the only gamification workshop out there that's accredited through both SHRM as well as ATD. And then in October, we're excited to continue to promote the arrival of Jim Kirkpatrick, who will be leading a workshop for us on October 4th about how to move your training evaluation from levels 1 and 2 to levels 3 and 4. And also some of our great upcoming partner events. In May will be the monthly Articulate Storyline user group meeting. On July 11th, Delaware SHRM will have its first ever Diversity and Inclusion Conference. In October, Delaware SHRM will also be holding its annual state conference. And in October as well, the PSPS Philadelphia Forum will be having its annual leadership discussion and breakfast. Look for these events as well as other events on our website at ldphilly.com. And don't forget, yearly membership is only $25. That yearly membership gives you access to not only our workshops and professional development series, it also gives you partnership pricing to our partner organizations, discounts on training classes from our partner Brookwood Media Arts, as well as discounts and other great promotions through some of our other sponsors, including Harrisburg University, Drexel University's Godwin School of Professional Studies, as well as other great L&D organizations here in the greater Philadelphia area. And one last shout out to our partner for the podcast series, Brookwood Media Arts. Since 1995, Brookwood has been recognized as a leading learning solutions provider, an industry educator, and a technology solutions developer, from conceptualization, design, and development to deployment, training, and support, Brookwood has the capabilities to deliver end-to-end solutions for their clients. More information about Brookwood at brookwood.com. As I mentioned at the start, we're in the studio this month with Cynthia Clay, one of the pioneers and continuous experts, in the world of virtual training. Cynthia, it's not only great to have you with us, it was great to have you in person earlier this month here in Philly.
Thank you. I had a great time being there. You've got some fabulous people in Philadelphia.
We do. And we appreciate you coming out. Both events went very well, and I feel sorry for the people who missed them.
Me too.
So as I stated at the beginning, we've got a cadence with our podcasts. Sometimes we use them as ways to get people interested in upcoming events. And then sometimes we do what we're doing this month, which is giving people who attended an event an opportunity to follow up, ask questions, and maybe continue to learn even more than what they did at the event. So we told people at both our Philly Tech Week event as well as the Professional Development Series event that they could submit questions to our website at info.ldphilly.com. And well, we've organized them, put them into an outline, and Cynthia, we're going to go ahead and get started with the Q&A.
All right.
So first couple of questions, just in case we've got listeners who didn't attend either one of our events. How did you move into the virtual training space?
Yeah. Well, I started as a basically an organization development and leadership development consultant, and all of my early training experience was stand and deliver training in the face-to-face classroom. And as we began to develop as a company, we developed a blended approach to leadership development. So, about the year 2000, we started to use the internet as a way to reinforce learning so that we would offer training in the classroom and then follow up with online reinforcement. Now, we are so used to that now, we don't realize that that was a brand new idea back then. So, we developed a whole bunch of post-class reinforcement tools that were web-based. And started offering those in 2000, 2001, 2002. So before it was even known as blended learning, that's what we were doing. And over the years, our clients started to ask us, well, this program was great, you know, if we taught one of our NetSpeed leadership modules, can you offer it online? Can you do it in WebEx? And we started to go, well, I don't know, what's WebEx, you know? So this was about 2006, 2007. One of our very first clients said, we're going to license your whole NetSpeed leadership program, but we want to deliver it in Sava Centra. And we said, great, what's that? So that's kind of how we got into it. We started looking at what our clients were trying to do with technology. And as I got interested, I began to ask myself, wow, how can we do this in such a way that if we're doing virtual instructor-led training, it's as engaging and interactive and interesting as what we might do in the face-to-face classroom? We started delivering what I call marketing webinars as a result of being introduced to the technology and became, I think, pretty adept at creating interactive events that were satisfying for me as a facilitator and for people that were participating. And so that's how we got into it. And I discovered, I was kind of laughingly say, I discovered rather late in life that I had a gift for delivering webinars. So who knew? And I have just over the years, continued to refine the techniques that we teach our clients. And I'm quite passionate about helping people do this effectively because I still see very poor webinar and web conference training. I want to help people learn to do this so that you get high quality results from training, just the same kind of results you would expect in the face-to-face classroom. That was a
Well,
long
since you meant
answer. Yeah.
quite okay. Well, you brought it up, and it was one of the questions that we had. What do you, since you work with a lot of businesses, you're one of the leaders in the field, what do you see the businesses or even training professionals doing wrong on a regular basis, whether it's virtual training or other uses of virtual platforms? What do you see on a consistent basis? Like if you had a top three or five list of here's what people do wrong all the time, what would that be?
Well, I think there's two areas where I would say I see issues. One is that I still see that people start to just throw PowerPoints up from a class that they did some other place into a web conference platform and try to deliver a training without really thinking about the delivery modality. And as a result, they may not have the same level of interaction and engagement. They may become more of a talking head presenter, facilitator, and they end up boring the socks off people. So everybody goes off and multitasks. And I think web workshops that, what people call webinars have gotten a pretty bad name because people think, oh, well, I'll just play that. I had a guy once tell me that he used webinars as an opportunity to mow his lawn. He would just play them, listen to them, go out and do a little work in his yard, And that's a shame because it's a modality, I think, that can be quite effective if we give the time and attention it needs to think about the design, how to get people involved, how to get them engaged, how to achieve learning goals in that environment. Instead, what I see is people just fall back on, I'm just going to deliver a presentation for 45 minutes and then ask you if you have questions. The other thing I see is for some reason, I have noticed that sometimes people don't do the same level of needs analysis that they might do if they were going to develop, say, a 2-day classroom workshop where they really want to be sure that what they're training is going to achieve the objectives they set out to achieve. They've really spent some time thinking about what is it we want people to be able to do as a result of attending this workshop. And I think because people delivering webinars and web workshops sometimes think, well, you can't practice skills, you can't do anything except deliver content. They actually don't do the same level of needs analysis to really understand what is it we're trying to accomplish in this webinar or web workshop. So those are two areas that I think I see as mistakes that people make when they move in here. And I would say one other thing about that, which is the web conference platform providers kind of lead you down the garden path because their marketing materials say, train thousands of people at the same time, And I always have to laugh because you can't train thousands of people at the same time. You can present information to thousands of people, but you really can't train them. So I think where the mismatch is thinking that presenting content, presenting information, building cognitive awareness is the same as developing skills, and it's not. And I think we can actually do more skill development in these web environments than we may at first think.
Yeah, I constantly remind people that ATD's best-selling book of all time and a workshop they put on at least a half a dozen times a year throughout the country, and it hasn't gone away at least in 15, 20 years, is telling in training.
Yeah. But it's
So.
sort of like we forgot that when we moved into the virtual classroom and into the web environment. It was like, well, okay, I guess telling will be training in here, but no, it's still not. So, yeah.
So related to that, what would you say when you look at the great trainers out there who do virtual training right, when you look at good companies that you've maybe worked with or maybe even helped develop, what are some of the things that they're doing right? What are their best practices?
I think one big one is they're not making the mistake of thinking that you can do everything in a webinar or a web workshop. So instead of looking at a 2-day training program and saying, how do I convert this 2-day program into an all virtual instructor-led training program? They're saying, what learning modalities make the most sense for each phase of the content that I'm looking at here? Do we need to rewrite the learning objectives? Do we need to look at a blend of perhaps we're going to get together face to face at the beginning, perhaps we're going to do some work online in a self-study environment, maybe with some e-learning applications, and then bring people together in a web conference environment, two or three times as part of that co course offering. So I think the best users of this technology see it as one tool in their toolkit, not the only tool in their toolkit. Now, we are passionate advocates of getting better at designing and delivering in this virtual classroom environment, but when we design for clients, we always produce a blended design. Maybe it's all blended online, but we do not try to take a 2-day workshop, as we're using as an example here, and just convert that into 2-hour webinars because you're really probably not going to have the best learning experiences for your participants if that's how you approach it. So that's I'm thinking about. What else? So we're thinking about best practices, and that's one is just to really approach the virtual classroom experience as one aspect of the learning tools that you might use in order to achieve your objectives. Once you're in here, the best practices are things like interaction every 2 to 3 minutes, and making sure that you're not just dropping a poll or a chat in, every few minutes because you're trying to keep people interested, but rather that it's totally integrated into the design of the experience. So I really love it when people have less of a presenting style and more of a facilitated learning style when they move into this environment, because they're going to be much more effective. You got to learn to ask juicy questions. You got to learn to give people lots of ways to engage with the content, with each other, and with you as the facilitator. And I have found the more I've done this that it's actually one of my favorite ways of delivering content and developing skills. And I never expected that. I love being face to face, but I also love being online in a virtual classroom environment.
All right, so you had presented at the Philly Tech Week event last week an idea around six principles from neuroscience, and we've organized most of the rest of the questions around those six principles. So the first principle was active engagement equals active brains. So one question that came in was, how do you persuade business leaders, SMEs, other folks from the business that you may be working with when it comes to developing training? How do you convince them, persuade them to allow you to make it engaging, right? Because I think a lot of people, particularly leaders who probably have, gone through enough education in their own lives, many often also forget about how they gained the expertise that they have, are simply content to allow somebody to talk at their folks for 45 minutes or a day or a week. So in the work that you do, particularly since virtual really does need to be so much more interactive than a typical classroom training because you don't have the same experience. What are you doing or what have you learned over the years that makes those conversations happen or convinces the leaders to say, yes, you know what, you're right. We can't have somebody talking at us for 45 minutes or a day or a week.
Well, I like to talk about the forgetting curve and present some of the research around how fast we forget what we have been exposed to in any classroom experience. Because depending on the study you look at, we forget 90% of what we learned within a week of an event. I saw one study that said within 24 hours of a learning event, we forget what we've learned. So in some ways, we have to help our senior leaders understand that simply presenting information doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have the impact that you want to have. So there's a bit of an education process here to help them see the value of active engagement. So I, you know, in setting up a course that I might be delivering with a client, I want to talk about the return on investment. What is the best way for you to get the return on investment in this course? So if you've spent, X dollars in developing a course and presenting it, what would that return be? And what is the best way to get that return? And within that context of talking about the return on investment that the organization wants to get from delivering this training, you can introduce some best practices that the research supports. There's, for now, I'll just say there's two that I want to talk about. One is that people are going to retain a lot more of what they learn if they're actively engaged in the process, if they're thinking about it, using it, applying it. And so that's one conversation to have. The other one is the program is going to be a lot more effective and actually be applied by learners if managers are supporting what's happening there. They know what's going to be trained in that program. They've had a conversation with the person who's going to be attending it. Perhaps they've set goals together. The manager is checking in to see how it's going. The manager maybe has a conversation afterward to see what they learned and how they applied it. So the research shows that the more engaged the manager is in supporting the learner in the training program, the more likely they'll actually use it, which is what we all want, right? So within the context of how do you get that return on investment, you help managers see they're critical to it. because they need to be there before and after to support the learner. And then you also make the case that within the learning event, it has to be engaging so that people are beginning to think about and apply the content while they're in the session. And that's different than attending a lecture. So those are the two, I think those are the two business cases that we have to make for our senior leaders, is it's not enough to just present content. So hope that helps a little bit.
No, I think it's a very good answer. And you touched on a lot of things that we're going to be talking about with some of the other questions that came in. So, around the idea of engagement and making sure that the virtual training that we design and deliver is engaging, one of the things, and this question came in from Ray, one of the things that is I've seen in my own personal life delivering new hire orientation or delivering technology training. What is your feeling on how do you make virtual training engaging if you've got people with a very wide experience level in the class, right? So let's say you've got, again, a new hire orientation program, or there's system training, or there's process training, something where you could have somebody who's got 10, 15, 20 years of experience in the field, they're using the tool or using the system under their belt, and for whatever reasons, logistical, budget, timing, yada yada yada, all of those things that can impact the shape of a training class. You've got newbies, you've got folks in there with very little experience in the company or in the industry or using the tool or using the process. Are there any tips or tricks to make
Well,
that situation
you
work?
know, that's an interesting situation that is true no matter where you're training, right? So we're always trying to figure out what's the level of knowledge that people have. And sometimes we have no control over who's going to show up. Whether, you know, you if I show up to give a talk, I can have people with, you know, no experience at all in delivering webinars or web workshops. And I can have other people who have said, geez, I've delivered hundreds of these. You know, show me what you got, you know? So it's not a challenge that's unique to the virtual classroom. If we are developing training internally, obviously we want to have more of a level playing field. So if we have an ability to identify, you know, to target the level of content that we're delivering so that it meets the needs of the majority of learners that are there, that's obviously ideal. But the reality is, we don't always have that ability. So, what's kind of fun about the virtual classroom is it's actually, I think, a better experience for both newbies and highly experienced people if you ask the right kinds of questions. So, you know, I make sure that we get out right up front, that we have a wide difference between our new people and our people with a lot of experience by asking some, you know, polls at the very beginning about their level of experience, by getting out from them what they most want to know in this session. And I want to be able to point out to everybody the gap between the people that have a lot of experience and a little experience. But then the thing that's great about the virtual classroom is that anytime I ask a question and have people chat about it, I can go ahead and see, I can pick out the best responses. And often those people that are really skilled are going to be giving more substantial responses to those chat questions. So they actually help then to create the learning experience for the people who are newbies. So I can praise them for their level of expertise and and what they're bringing to that learning experience that we're creating together. And then for our newbies, you know, I sometimes may acknowledge you may not know exactly what the answer is here, but you're about to get some rich insight from the really experienced people that are in this session. So I actually think it's easier to manage that dynamic when you're in a web conference learning environment than when you're in a face-to-face environment.
Okay, so I can probably spend half an hour unpacking that. So, but kind of jumping from the idea of we need training to be engaging. The second principle that you presented was neurons that fire together wire together. And a question that I really resonated with me when I saw it come in was around. People can be so used to passive learning, right? I mean, let's face it, probably most of the training that companies and organizations do out there is quite passive. So if you're developing training for the virtual space for an organization that maybe beats into its head, its people's head, this idea of passive learning, right? There's just not enough time to make it interactive, or there's not enough time to develop interactive learning, or there's not buy-in from leadership to make it interactive. Is there anything in the design or in the planning for virtual training that can help get some of those passive learners engaged earlier, more comfortable earlier? Because and I've seen it myself. People that are so used to passive training don't know what to do when they get into an interactive environment.
Well, this is, I think, we're sort of having to retrain people. I find that people who have attended a lot of bad webinars in the past may arrive at my webinars and my workshops and think, oh, this is going to be, I'm just going to watch this, So right up front, if we send out a welcome email, we set the expectation that you're not going to want to do anything else while you're attending because you're going to be participating actively all the way through. I may share with people the brain research that shows that if you are engaged, if your senses, multiple senses are engaged while you're learning, you're more likely to remember it. So I give them a reason to want to participate by sharing some of the research around why participation is important. And especially if they're going to have to take a test or demonstrate competence in something, the what's in it for me is you're going to remember a lot more of this if you're actively engaged with me. I will also then set the expectation up front. It's going to be highly participative, and I may be calling on people as well. So I put them on alert that they could be called on. And all of those things are designed to ensure that they are ready to learn in an interactive way. And then when they arrive at the event, we actually get them chatting right up front with a fun kind of just a fun warm-up question, So one of the questions that we ask in one of our leadership courses is, what's one thing you'd like to hear from your boss today? Which is just a fun question that gets them chatting, and they're chatting things like, here's your 15% raise. These are the things they'd like to hear from their boss today. So it's a fun question. It gets them warmed up. And we do that as people are arriving before the session starts. And then from the get-go, we're asking them to participate. They're taking polls, they're using their status icons, because the message we want to send from the opening 2 minutes of this session is, this is not like any other web experience you've had so far. Because what people normally do is, it's 15, 20 minutes into a webinar before they ask you to answer a poll. And by that time, you're so bored, you're off doing something else. So I think it's those are all the ways that we set it up. So we explain why it's important. We start them communicating with each other early, and then we make sure that there is a lot of interaction from the very beginning that is integrated into the learning that we're doing together.
All right, and you actually answered the next question on in that section. So I'm going to jump over to the third principle you shared was that vision trumps other senses. And I'm going to take one of the questions that came in and break it off and add a second part to the question from me. So one question we had come in was, how do you balance the need to deliver content versus making the slide deck, for lack of a better term, visually appealing, the graphics visually appealing that we're using in the virtual platform. I want to slap on to that a question of my own, because during the presentation last week, you had mentioned, and you actually showed the example of, instead of giving the god-awful bullet points on the screen, to break them up to give each bullet point its own slide and to use imagery to represent the concept as opposed to just using a static bullet point. However, I'm a big fan of Robert Gagne and the nine events of instruction, which says, basically the old line about tell people what you're going to tell them and then tell them. And the steps in Guyanese process include, giving people a quick, here's what you're going to learn, and then you guide them through the process. So, number one, how do we deliver content, that we need to deliver, making it still visually appealing? And then, second question or second part of the question for me would be, is there anything wrong though with using bullet points to intro or summarize topics, right? As long as you've got those individual slides so that when you're talking about point A, only point A is on the screen.
Yeah, so there's some, Seth Godin's done some interesting work, and we sometimes use his some of his podcasts and infographics in our training. But he talks about really bad PowerPoint, and if you want to go Google him and look him up, he's got some great things to say. I've noticed that people who do public speaking tend to rely on fewer slides. The slides they do bring up tend to be really interesting graphically, and one or two key messages. So there's often eye-popping graphics, eye-catching graphics. And there is a difference between a public speaker who's delivering a motivational message, for example, in which you could rely almost entirely on really beautiful graphic slides with, one key message per slide, and what we have to do, which is train people, right? So, and oftentimes we expect them to take a deck away, take that slide deck away with the key points on it. So a couple of things about this. First of all, I do use bullet points, and I also do what I call benchmarking. So, if I have six, I presented 6 points in the brain-based learning in the virtual classroom, and I had a slide that had six bars on it, and then each point, as I went back to the point, came up in one of those bars. So there was the framework, and then each point was made, and it built over time. That's giving you that structure, kind of the scaffolding. So you know what's coming, and you've got the framework for those six key points. And then within those six brain-based principles, I think for each one, there was a slide that had four or five bullet points. He's like, these are the key messages I want you to take away. But there were also plenty of slides where there was just a beautiful image that evoked a response. And so I try to use a combination of both. Sometimes I'll do, I've got a client who does this. I don't do this very often, but sometimes I do this. My slide deck as the presenter is different than the participant's slide deck that they might take away at the end. So I may have a slide deck that they take away at the end that has a lot more bullet points in it because it's going to be their reference tool. But what I'm presenting from may have fewer bullet points and more images. So their takeaway may have a lot more content than what I'm talking about when we're in the web event. So that's another way that you can approach it. I know that sometimes we feel a little intimidated by the need to suddenly have better graphics. I have to say, I really have a lot of fun with this. So I have my own account at a couple of places where you can buy images, really inexpensive. Mine is, one I like is deposit photos. And I love going and thinking about what is the theme that encapsulates the most important messages that I have in the session, and then finding images that reflect that theme. It actually is kind of fun for me. So not everybody may have that visual sense and get a charge out of doing that. And so you probably, maybe you have somebody on your team that likes to do that, and you get their help. But I think the call to all of us in the virtual classroom is to really up our game graphically and visually in what we're presenting, because there's just no way to hold people's attention with boring bullet point slides. And the whole challenge, I think, in this learning environment is to make it such an attractive, attention-keeping experience that your learners don't peel off and go multitask. So that's the challenge. And certainly, the more compelling your slides are visually, the more you'll work against that. One thing I will say, and you may have mentioned this, but we really recommend a lot more slides in the virtual environment. So in a 60-minute web workshop, I may have 60 to 75 slides, which seems crazy, but I've just I want to use those slides as my attention management tool. So we're going to spend less than a minute per slide. And so when you've changed that slide to something else interesting that's got important information or a beautiful image or an image that evokes a response or that's related to the content, then people look back again. You get their attention again, even if they had drifted away for a minute. So I think of our PowerPoint slides in these web conference platforms as our number one attention management tool.
Had was back in February, we had Andy Jefferson, who's one of the co-founders and co-authors of The 6 Ds to Breakthrough Learning. Have you ever come across Andy or any of his work?
No, he's not. I'm not familiar with him. I'll have to go check him out.
Yeah, it's good. And not to belabor the discussion, basically The 6 Ds is about the wraparound processes that we need in the business world to supplement good instructional design, right? So not just doing a good needs analysis, right? But how do you build the front end processes with the business around getting that information, right? How do you do real performance support, right? So it's a more holistic view of ID that's not just focused on the learning output, but on the business and the business processes and the business outcomes. Anyway, one of Andy's main points in his presentation, and it's in the 6 Ds, and actually, at Comcast, we in the sales college where I work, we actually follow the 6 Ds as our start to finish process. One of the main points of the 6 Ds, and you had mentioned this briefly earlier, was a critical need to get manager buy-in and support. Particularly in the area of preparing people for class, as well as following up and reinforcing what's been learned. So when we're talking about designing and delivering virtual training, in the work that you've done with many different companies, what do you think that good companies are doing in order to get manager buy-in? Or if you can't answer that, maybe, in your mind, how critical is it to have manager buy-in and support for good virtual training in order to take that learning that happens in the classroom, and then transfer it back onto the
Yeah.
job?
I over the years, because I've done training in the face-to-face and the virtual classrooms for over 25 years now. And one thing I've noticed, and I'm going to make up a statistic, so it's like factoid coming. I say maybe 10 to 20% of our learners are so self-motivated that they'll sign up for a class, come, take it, complete it, and actually apply it. It's just a very small number. I always like them when I run into them because they're just eager, enthusiastic learners. They love to learn. They're self-motivated. It would be great if everybody was like that. But the reality is that many people are really kind of going to this, whatever this training thing is, because they were told to go. And that until they know why they're there, the what's in it for me, and why they're there, why does this matter to me? How am I going to be able to use it? How's it going to help me be more effective? They're probably not going to participate as actively as we would want. So I am a big believer in that manager wraparound that you're describing, because the every study I've shown says that you're going to have the greatest application of learning if the manager is part of the system. So the manager has got to be there before and after to say, this is important. What is it you want to gain from going to this session? Here's what you're going to be able to do as a result of being there. What are your goals? So there's a bit of a there's a almost like a learner agreement that happens at the front end. And then at the back end, the manager's there to go, tell me what you learned. How are you going to use that? Go use it and tell me how it went. So if the manager is integrated into the system itself, you will get nearly 100% application. So one study I looked at it said it was like 95% of the learners said they applied it and they saw an impact in their work. And when you trace back to what's critical to get people to actually use it, usually, invariably, manager support is part of the process. If you remove that and you just do training in a vacuum, the number of people who say they actually use it drops to like 25%, which is in alignment with what I've observed, which is that most of us don't take the time to actually use it. So, what do you put in place so that you extend the learning beyond the event of coming to a virtual classroom experience? What do you put to reinforce their use of it? The kinds of things we develop with our clients, we call pre and post work or post class reinforcement tools. We have a number of licensed programs in leadership, customer service, conflict resolution. They all have post class reinforcement. We want to give people a reason to revisit what they learned, to think about how they're going to apply it, to apply it, and then report back on how it went. And we want to give the manager an easy way to support that process. So it's to answer the question, it's critical. It's critical that the manager is involved. So we have to help managers see why this is so important. And again, I talked earlier about the return on investment. We want to help them see that the organization will not get the return on investment unless the manager is actively involved. Now, one of my favorite theorists is Robert Brinkerhoff, and he talks about the success case method for demonstrating that training has had an impact. And in his work, he has developed what he calls a training impact map. So we've adapted that to many of our training programs. Basically, what a training impact map does is help you draw a line between the training that we're offering and the strategic objectives of the organization. So you first think about what are the objectives of this program? If somebody takes this program, what will they be able to do as a result? How will that impact the business? How will that business impact have an ultimate impact on the organization's strategic objectives? So you think through those steps of training impact so that you can articulate that for both the manager that you're trying to say, we need your support, and for the participants, so you can help them see why this is so important. So that's all about creating context and putting the impact into words for people and helping draw that straight line between here are the learning objectives, of this program, and all the way to here's the strategic objectives of our organization and why this program is so important in helping us reach it.
So you mentioned the word context there, which I think is critical and something that we miss a lot of in adult ed and in corporate training is the idea that learning doesn't happen, or learning can't be transferred if it's learned out of context. The next principle that you shared was around no pain means no gain. And this kind of ties in a little bit back to another question that we had talked about earlier around, the situation where you've got people of varying experience and skill levels together in the same class. How important is it in to know your audience, to know what you're designing for, so that you can make things difficult so they enjoy it and they learn from it, but not so difficult that they get frustrated, or too easy where they just check out because, I learned this, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I think you're pointing to the need to really understand your audience, their experience, their education level, what they've already mastered, as you're designing those kinds of experiences. And I talk about the Goldilocks principle. Not so much pain that you shut everybody down. Nobody wants to be embarrassed. Nobody wants to fail publicly and feel bad about themselves. So how do you create the conditions so that failure is safe, right? So that failure doesn't embarrass me, it's not humiliating. So that we all have the experience together of trying to accomplish a task and realizing we need more support or more information or more skill in order to be able to successfully accomplish that. So this is it's a little bit of an art, So if you give people a really challenging case and say, take a first crack at it and see what you come up with, and you know that they're going to have to experience the next 45 minutes to be able to actually resolve that thing successfully. Then after your 45 minutes of content, for example, you're going to come back at the end and say, try again. And they basically get to prove to themselves that what they learned changed the outcome in that case. So failure may not look like I completely blew it. It may just look like, well, I might have solved that kind of, that's the opening. And then at the end, there's the experience of, wow, this is 100% better than what we came up with at the beginning. So they basically proved to themselves that what they learned made a difference in the deliverable or the product at the end. It would be like, I'm just a,
Yeah, and another
go,
question.
I'm just going to just give you an example. It would be like if you were teaching people how to use PowerPoint, for example, you give them three slides and some content and say, do your best on this, and they get a chance to look at it. Then you would give them, here's some principles that we want you to apply to your PowerPoint at the end of this session, and you would let them audit their own work. So that they could audit and go, oh, I don't have enough graphics, and oh man, I've got too much text. You give them the guidelines that they can use to audit what they did, so they see, this could be better. And then eventually, at the end of that session on PowerPoint, just to use that as an example, they then apply all of the techniques that you introduced to that first attempt to maybe redesign three slides, and they go, yowza, this is way better. So that's what I mean by, no pain, no gain. I got to try it first and then see, ah, this could be better than what I did in my first attempt.
And I think it ties in very beautifully with, the concept that adults really bring their own experience to the classroom. Having started my life as a high school teacher, not that kids or teenagers don't have previous life experience, but not to the same extent that an adult does. And I think too, and you had mentioned this at the free talk with Philly Tech Week, and it is going back to my friend Robert Gagné, one of his nine principles. Around, activating, stimulating prior knowledge, right? And I think what you just, the example you just gave there is great. You give people the opportunity to say, hey, here's what I already know. And then the tips, the tricks, the principles, whatever the content is, you allow people to go back to that first attempt and to make adjustments, because that's when the real learning happens, when they can say, oh, well, this is the way I did it. Maybe that's not the best way to do something. So, yeah, now let's put it this way. Another question came in, and this is another one of my points that I constantly harp on in our podcasts or in discussion with other L&D professionals. It's around the idea of failure, right? I mean, I think, we run businesses around the idea of nobody's allowed to make mistakes. So how do we convince leaders though that making mistakes, and the question came in as failure, but let's say we don't mean like fail as in oops, the nuclear power plant explodes,
Hope
right?
not.
But yeah, I mean, how do you convince leadership, how do you change that culture that maybe doesn't accept failure as part of training? Because quite frankly, it's number one, it's more work. Number two, it's more time consuming, right? I mean, it ties into that earlier question about convincing leaders to allow you to make training engaging and interactive and not just a talking head for however long you've got them in the room or the virtual platform. So if people are saying, hey, I love what you've been sharing already, you've given some great tips, last week and now, via these answers to some of these questions. But God, like the minute we start talking about like allowing people to like try something and make mistakes, then my SME or my business partner is just going to shut down.
Well, first of all,
So.
I would not use the word failure. We're allowed to fail because I think people would go, no, that sounds painful, right? But I think what we say, I mean, I would say you never want to tell somebody you're an empty vessel, and until you leave this class, you won't know anything, Because the truth is, we all come with experience and skills. So instead of doing that, I would say you all have skills and experience in this area. And you may know more than I do in some of these areas. So this is a collective learning experience. We're going to try some cases out. We're going to see if we're going to see what our starting point is and where we might wind up after delving into some content here. It is a so it's not anything that you're doing to somebody, I guess is what I would say. And I probably wouldn't even talk about failure. I would say my job is to help you enhance what you already know. And you take what allows you to enhance your skills here, because not everybody's going to take away the same things. We all come with different levels of skills and experience. So my job is to help create conditions so that you can learn something else that's just going to keep helping you improve. And that's the context for it, versus saying, I'm going to create conditions for you to fail. And then we'll see how you do after that, because I would say most adults would go run for the hills. They don't, nobody wants to be told, we're going to set you up so that you fail. Nobody wants to do that. And as adults, I think one of the reasons kids learn so much more easily than we do, because when you're a kid and you're just experimenting, and you're out building a bridge over a pond, for example, and trying to figure out how do you construct that so that, it actually, picturing a little tiny bridge over a little tiny pond, with kids like playing together, they're not concerned about how they look, right? They're just concerned about how do you make that bridge work? And as we get older as adults, we're way more concerned with how we look, right? We don't want to look dumb. We want to look intelligent. We want to look like we're the most competent person in the room. So you don't want to trigger all those feelings that adults get into about whether they look good or bad. Instead, you want to create a kind of learning environment that's just fun. We're just enjoying the process. So I often think about that. The way we used to just play as kids, can I create that? Can I create an experiential exercise that's just fun? And then when we reflect on it, we go, oh, that's interesting. I learned some things there that are going to help me be more effective back in the work that I do.
If I could reach for the screen right now and give you a hug, I would, because that was an answer that sounded like it would have come from my heart. So along those same lines, the sixth and final principle that you shared was that practice makes perfect.
Permanent practice makes permanent practice makes permanent.
I know, but hey. I'm a sales guy, and practice makes perfect sounds better. No, but yeah. So practice makes permanent, which ties into what we talked about in terms of taking the learning, transferring back onto the job, seeing training, and you said it, you literally said it yourself. Provide that post-training follow-up because unless it sticks in a long-term memory, then you have forgotten it, right? Whether you forget 10% or 20%, or it's more likely 70 to 80, maybe even 90% of what you hear. Or even what you maybe do if you only do it once. So all that said, practice is expensive. Practice is time consuming. Practice is all the things that the business side of the house hates, right? It costs time, it costs resources, it costs money. And I don't want to get into discussions of ROI, right? Or the pay me now, pay me later dichotomy, right? You either pay me now to train these people well, or you pay me later when you're hiring people and I'm doing this again in 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years. But outside of those kinds of things, are there, as you've worked with leaders, as you've worked with great companies, over the last 20 plus years, have you seen smart L&D folks have those conversations or other things they do that really highlights to the business side that, you know what, this is important, right? I mean, it's kind of like the culmination of everything that we've talked about, right? So we want it to be engaging. We want people to be able to bring their own experience out. We want people to be able to learn from each other to create that collaborative environment. We need that post-training manager support. But whether we do it in the classroom or we do it outside of the classroom and then come back and get a kind of do a post-training follow-up on, hey, how did everybody do? Blah, 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 blah. What are great L&D professionals doing to, whisper back at the business? Yeah, but you know what? It's not just a one and done. It's not just a talking head. It's that we need to practice, right? I mean, Allen Iverson, the former 76er here in Philadelphia, was famous of, his rants 15 years ago. Practice? They're talking about practice. Yes, we're talking about practice. And if you want to make it stick, you got to practice. So, what are we doing? What are we doing here?
Well, okay. So there's a couple of pieces here that you're making me think about. One is that in the conversation at the front end, a question that I like to pose for people if I'm interviewing a senior leader who said, for example, let's just make an example. Let's say they've decided we want to train everybody in conflict resolution. I want to find out why you want to train everybody in conflict resolution. And I want to be sure there really is a legitimate skill need there. What's behind this, right? I just as an aside, had a conversation once with a senior leader that wanted to train everybody in conflict resolution. And as I probed as to why, what would be different if they all knew how to resolve conflict and what would the organization be like if everybody was skilled there, it became really clear that there was one person on the team that was really tough to work with. And so what he was really saying is, help us all learn to deal with this person, And, so training is the wrong solution there, right? I looked at him and just said, you have a different problem because it isn't that everybody needs to be trained to resolve conflict, it's that you need to deal with a performance issue, right? So when we have those discussions up front, we really want to make sure that we know why people have glommed onto training as the solution because maybe that's not the right thing to be doing. That's the first thing. So the more you demonstrate your credibility by not always pulling training out of your toolkit, right? So by sometimes going, you know what would be better here is just a performance aid that's got the 10 steps they got to follow, so that we can laminate it and stick it on the wall next to them and they can look, right? If we're saying, I think this is a need for a performance aid, or I think this is a need for some coaching, versus always accepting when a leader says, we want to train everybody in conflict resolution, right? Now, let's say you ask those questions and that you realize, yeah, baby, they would benefit from being trained in conflict resolution. Then you can start to dig a little deeper. And this is the kind of question that I would ask. How important is it that someone is able to resolve that conflict when they first experience it versus, for example, escalating it to a supervisor? So how important is it that they can resolve the conflict with a customer, as an example, at the moment that it occurs? And get the leader to articulate how important that is. If they can't do that, what happens as a result? And get the leader to talk about, well, it gets escalated to the supervisor, and then the supervisor has to spend time doing da da da. And then get them to articulate what's the cost to the business if they don't have the skill to resolve that conflict at the first conversation with the customer. So that con you ask, how do you get people to buy into practice? Well, you get them having the conversation about what is the skill that needs to be developed? How important is it that they practice that before they go live with a customer, for example? So that conversation is really about their goals and their objectives, if you can hear that. It isn't about us educating them that we need more practice. Does that make sense? Because if they were to come back and say, it's not important, right? I just want them to know about it, but I don't care whether they're able to actually do it, which I doubt anybody would ever say, but then okay, well, this is going to be an information session. But usually people will say it's pretty important that they know how to do X, design the PowerPoint or resolve the conflict or de-escalate an emotional situation, whatever that might be. And then you can start to talk about, okay, what's the best way to make sure they know how to do that? And practice is often one of the ways that you get there. And you can explain that that's going to take a bit longer. While we're on that topic, I have to tell you, a lot of what's happening in the talent development space, right now, I think sets us up for some problems because we seem to, over the last few years, with the emergence of technology, we have conflated information acquisition with skill development. So what we really have to do if we're going to be effective in our organizations is help explain the difference. Just because you know something doesn't mean you can do something. So, just having that conversation about what is it they have to know as the first step, and then what is it we want them to be able to do, and then as a result of learning that, and then how important is it that they can do it well when they go back to the job? That's the conversation that we want to have because practice is a natural outgrowth of that conversation. Everybody can see you're not going to get to the end point of being able to do it well without some practice along the way.
Yeah, I had worked for an off-price retail for several years in their L&D, and one of the things that I did not work directly on, but a colleague did, was developing a onboarding program for assistant buyers. If you don't know much about the merchandise world, there are people who go out and work with vendors to determine who. How much of something we should buy, should we buy it, what colors do we buy, yada, yada, yada. So, and in the merchandise world, those entry-level jobs really aren't entry-level in the sense that, most of the people coming in were young professionals, probably more than likely was their first job out of college. And all of a sudden, they're thrust into a position where they're managing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth, if not millions of dollars worth of merchandise. And while theoretically they would report into a senior buyer, the way it typically worked was they were still responsible for a specific category or subcategory. So they had to basically do a job to which they were not given much training. Even if they had gone to, there's actually a number of schools on the East Coast. One here, actually, right in Philadelphia, that focus on quote unquote, they call it fashion merchandising, or maybe they came with an accounting background. I mean, even if you had a good financial background, I mean, this is the type of job where you're only in the office 2 days a week, 2, 3 days a week. You're in New York, you're negotiating with clients, you're taking a look at new materials, you're planning the next season, or you're looking for the next hot trend. One day a week, or at least one day every other week, you're in the stores in the field and in competitor stores doing comp shopping, and you're doing all that while using, 10, 15 different systems and, 20, 25 different, internal systems and all the stuff. And I mean, they burn through 100% of people in a 2 year period because they had no onboarding. And it's exactly to your point. I mean, there were many reasons. One of them is, no, I think you hit the nail on the head. We always, almost always, I would say, confuse information acquisition with skill development. I know all 197 countries of the world. What can I do with that information? Well, I had a very lonely childhood. I studied maps. I can actually point to them on a map. So that's another level up. But outside of that, I mean, really, what could I do? I mean, if I crossed the border from China into India, if there wasn't a marker, I wouldn't be able to tell you until I started to hear Chinese switch over to Man not Mandarin, Mandarin switch over into Hindi or into Pashtun or something else.
I think I think we as learning professionals at the front end need to help clients articulate what people need to know, what people need to be able to do, and at what level of competence. So it's like, how well do they need to know how to do it? And that's part of our job at the beginning is to help them put that into words so they can see, okay, then we can show, okay, here's the techniques that we'll use to get there, so that they can see that's why we're doing what we're doing versus, here's a bunch of content we want you to figure out how to present, right? Because, like, if I start with the content without knowing what my objectives are and what I'm trying to achieve, then I'm just going to develop that talking head presentation full of content and think, I'll check the box off and say I delivered a training on that, and I may feel good for a minute, but I'm not going to have the business impact that I want to have.
All right, well, that takes up all of our time. Cynthia, as always, it was such a pleasure to have a conversation with
Thank
you.
you.
Look forward to having more in the future. We appreciate you joining us for our monthly podcast. We'll also take this opportunity to thank Joanne, our producer, as well as the rest of the folks at Brookwood for their continued support of our podcast series. And remind everyone to check out our website at ldphilly.com for upcoming events, as well as partner events, membership benefits, resources, and more. Thanks, everyone.